This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Our Lost Constitution, The Willful Subversion of America's Founding Document by Mike Lee, performed by Mike Lee and Tom Parks. Chapter 1. Ducking and Dodging the Constitution. I keep two towers of documents in my Senate office. The first is only a few inches tall, a collection of all the legislation passed by Congress in 2013. It contains about 800 pages. The second tower, which is 11 feet tall, is a collection of regulations proposed and adopted by federal agencies in 2013. It contains about 80,000 pages. These extraordinarily unequal towers illustrate a startling reality. The U.S. Congress no longer passes most of the federal laws, rules, and regulations that are imposed on the American people. While a mountain of those rules are decreed by an army of unelected federal bureaucrats, only about 1% of the rules we must live by are enacted by the most accountable branch of government, Congress. Using a classic duck-and-dodge strategy, Congress routinely enacts legislation that purports to solve a genuine problem but provides no specific solutions. Congress then delegates to executive branch bureaucrats the power to make legally binding rules or regulations, which will themselves determine the law's real-world impact. It's a brilliant plan. Congress gets all the credit for the popular goal and none of the blame for the controversial particulars of regulation. One prominent example of this kind of lawmaking can be found in the Clean Air Act. The act essentially declares that we shall have clean air, and then outlines a broad vision for limiting air pollution from both mobile sources, like cars, and stationary sources, like factories. The act contains relatively few details as to how its laudable objectives will be achieved. Instead, it authorizes the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, to make and enforce legally binding regulations that, far more than the act itself, restrict air pollution. This approach certainly has its advantages, and few would dispute that America's air quality has improved substantially since the Clean Air Act's passage and implementation. I'm happy, as I assume all Americans are, that the Clean Air Act has improved our nation's air quality. There is, however, a major problem with this method of lawmaking. It insulates lawmakers from voter accountability and thereby undermines one of our Constitution's most important features. It insulates members of Congress by giving them plausible deniability. They can blame the executive agencies for anything the voters don't like. The bureaucrats at those agencies, in turn, become a unique and privileged class of lawmakers. They are insulated from voter accountability because they are never required to stand for election. Thus, when the EPA adopts a new regulation carrying the force of law, those who find that law unnecessary, unreasonable, or even harmful are left with little recourse. Understandably, they might complain to those who have been elected to represent them in Congress. Members of Congress instinctively respond to such complaints by expressing empathy for those harmed by the law and frustration with the EPA, and then adding something like, "Well, that regulation was put in place by the EPA. That is where you should take your complaint." Of course, the people at the EPA, as hardworking, well-educated, and well-intentioned as they may be, tend not to be terribly concerned about citizen complaints because they cannot be voted out of office. It can be hard for most Americans, that is, those who don't work in Congress or monitor its operations on a full-time basis, to understand how far our government has drifted from the Constitution's vision and, in many cases, its actual stated provisions. Many Americans probably assume that our lawmakers understand our founding document and are devoted to defending it. Unfortunately, that assumption is in many ways incorrect. Far too many members of Congress don't understand the Constitution they've sworn to defend, not because they can't understand it, but because they make little or no effort to do so. Some Supreme Court justices aren't much better. Too many of them understand our founding document, but refuse to acknowledge that its most important function is to limit and check power. Presidents are often even worse. They pay lip service to our nation's governing document with their words, but their actions frequently betray a lack of real commitment to its restrictions. People serving in each of these positions have raised their right hands and sworn some variation of an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. Most, if not all, of the people who have made such a vow intended at the outset to keep it. Maybe they believe they are keeping it. But far too often, they are not. The truth is that our Constitution is being subverted by many of the very people who have solemnly promised to protect it. Most of the destruction is done by well-meaning government officials who believe that our governing document is more of a starting point than a necessary set of boundaries. Those who espouse this view tend to profess a kind of reverence for the Constitution, but talk about its restrictive structure with a combination of detachment and disdain. They make it clear that they think the idea of restraining government power by means of a written governing document is a topic better suited for an ancient history class than for a contemporary political discussion. Adherents to this viewpoint will occasionally say that the Constitution was crafted by and for an agrarian society, meaning that it is a sort of quaint document written for a society that is nothing like our own. As far as these critics are concerned, we don't need to follow a bunch of rigid rules put in place by Americans who grew their own food and whose most sophisticated mode of transportation involved a horse and buggy. When I arrived in Washington, I found it awash with people who viewed the Constitution as a nuisance. There was an attorney general who, contradicting experts within his own Department of Justice, vouched for the constitutionality of a legislative proposal that would give the District of Columbia representation in Congress, even though the Constitution makes clear that only states are entitled to such representation. There was a president who had bullied and badgered the Supreme Court after it issued a free speech decision with which he disagreed. And there was an outgoing Speaker of the House, who, when asked which provision of the Constitution gives Congress authority to make Americans buy health insurance, answered with scorn and incredulity by simply replying, "Are you serious? Are you serious?" Rather than considering the Constitution important enough for their consideration, many senators and congressmen now punt constitutional questions to staff, who in turn defer, often excessively, to the courts in construing the Constitution. If you ask senators or congressmen about the constitutionality of a particular legislative proposal, they might well answer, "Experts on my staff have assured me that if this bill becomes law, the courts will not invalidate it." Relying on court decisions is no substitute for legitimate, independent constitutional analysis, which should take place within every branch of government. Every elected official has an affirmative, independent obligation to act within the Constitution's limits, regardless of whether courts are likely to intervene. Lawmakers who don't move beyond the question of what the courts will permit are like children trying to get away with a kind of rule-breaking their parents aren't likely to catch. It was this state of affairs that convinced me to run for the U.S. Senate in 2010, challenging a three-term incumbent from my own party. It bothered me that even in the Republican Party, far too many elected officials have been reluctant to engage the public in a meaningful constitutional discourse. Although the GOP purports to stand for principles of constitutionally limited government, not every Republican lawmaker is willing to engage in a thoughtful constitutional dialogue, one that attempts to identify limits on federal power and extends beyond a facile assessment of how likely the courts might be to invalidate a particular law. Sometimes government officials overlook serious constitutional defects in a legislative proposal because they see that some features of the proposal may be popular. It is politically advantageous for them to defer all constitutional questions to the courts, which can then carry all responsibility, and any accompanying blame, for the proposal's unconstitutionality. President George W. Bush, for example, signed the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act of 2002, also known as the McCain-Feingold Act, even though he knew major parts of it violated Americans' right to free speech. He explained that certain provisions present serious constitutional concerns, that questions arise under the First Amendment regarding a limit on individual campaign contributions, and that he had reservations about the constitutionality of another major provision restricting political advertising. But in a shocking abrogation of his constitutional duty to defend the Constitution, Bush signed the bill, meekly explaining, "I expect that the courts will resolve these legitimate legal questions as appropriate under the law." In so doing, he forced upon the American people an onerous set of legal obligations that he himself recognized were constitutionally infirm. Americans had to either humbly submit to an unconstitutional law or go through the time-consuming, expensive, and politically risky exercise of challenging the law in court. 8 years after Bush acknowledged this law's constitutional defects but refused to veto it, the Supreme Court invalidated parts of it. Liberals went wild, demanding a constitutional amendment to repeal part of the First Amendment and heaping on the court the criticism that Bush had deflected and that continues to this day. Even though the Supreme Court righted some of Bush's wrongs, many of our constitutional rights cannot, or for one reason or another will not, be addressed by the courts. To put it simply, the Constitution has to be defended by all three branches of government. Now, more than ever, we need our elected officials to think about these things and enforce provisions of the Constitution that courts have not been willing to enforce. Our lost Constitution tells the stories behind some of the most important of those provisions. Each of the chapters in Part 1 describes the story behind the rise and fall of a particular constitutional provision. Why was that provision included in the Constitution? What does it mean? And how did we forget it? In every case, the clause at issue fell victim to the dangerous and deliberate choices of powerful people, some well-intentioned, others more malevolent, who put their own agendas above the fundamental values of our Constitution. Part 2 explains how the Constitution's lost clauses can be brought back to life. Each of Part 2's chapters describes a different mechanism for resurrecting the lost Constitution, from the power litigants have demonstrated in their fight for the Second Amendment, to the potential for legislators to rein in executive abuse by controlling the purse and passing new laws, to the importance of voters making informed choices based on candidates' commitment to aggressively protect the Constitution they will, if elected, swear to uphold. No single one of these mechanisms is sufficient. We will reclaim our Constitution only when litigants, judges, elected officials, and most important, voters, decide that the lost Constitution must not remain lost forever. Chapter 10. What You Can Do to Reclaim the Constitution. When the state of New York opened its convention to ratify the Constitution in June 1788, few states were more important to the Union's success than the Empire State. Yet in few other states did ratification appear more improbable, because New Yorkers had a lot to lose. The new Constitution would make customs duties, the state's most lucrative revenue stream, a national tax. It would also allow Congress to force New Yorkers to help pay other states' war debts, even though New Yorkers had already paid off their own debt. It's no wonder that New York voters sent to the convention 19 supporters of the Constitution and 46 opponents. Against these almost impossible odds, New York's Alexander Hamilton defended the Constitution section by section and clause by clause. At the National Convention in Philadelphia, he had sometimes stumbled. But at the ratifying convention in Poughkeepsie, and in the Federalist Papers written to shift public opinion across the state, he was masterful. After the first week of debate was filled with anti-Federalist forceful and emotional attacks on the Constitution, Hamilton pleaded for a cool examination of the instrument in question. The understandable doubts, suspicions, and speculations of opponents were based on centuries of central governments trampling on the rights of their people. But the United States was different, because we have formed a constitution upon free principles. Among them was the principle of free representation. Never in America would its people need to fear an out-of-control government. In America, most federal legislators hold their offices 2 years and then return to their constituents. Here, said Hamilton, the constituents are always in charge. Here, sir, the people govern. Hamilton had come a long way from his proposal in Philadelphia for an elected monarch, although he had never been opposed to a popularly elected House of Representatives. And in the end, the New York Ratifying Convention was persuaded by the power of his arguments and by the promise of a Bill of Rights. On July 26th, by just 3 votes, the convention in Poughkeepsie ratified the United States Constitution. In a celebratory parade through New York City produced by the Constitution's supporters, a 27-foot-long float in the shape of a frigate sailed through the streets of Manhattan. The ship was called the Hamilton. Hamilton's words, "Here, sir, the people govern," capture the reason why the lost Constitution will never be a lost cause. In the United States, the people always ultimately have the power to rein in, redirect, or kick out their elected representatives. They need only marshal the political will to do so. As the previous 3 chapters showed, Congress and the courts each have a role to play in reclaiming the Constitution. But if we wait around for them to act on their own initiative, we will be waiting forever. The Second Amendment was not resurrected until advocates like Clark Neely, Robert Levy, and Dick Heller forced the courts to resurrect it. The Raines Act and the USA Freedom Act will not pass until constituents force their representatives to pass them. And Congress will never use its power over the purse to reclaim the Constitution unless voters elect legislators who understand our founding charter and are committed to respecting it. Reclaiming our constitutional principles, therefore, begins with the American voter. Only we can force our government officials to obey their oaths to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. Only we can reshape our nation's attitudes, actions, and elections in a way that will restore the lost Constitution. Attitudes. First, we have to influence the attitudes of those around us, making every effort to persuade our friends, neighbors, colleagues, aunts and uncles, even the crazy ones who we think will never listen, that constitutionally limited government not only matters, but is essential to our prosperity as a nation and to our way of life. Ronald Reagan made a similar point in 1977 when he explained that if we truly believe in our principles, we should sit down and talk. He implored those who share our values to talk with anyone, anywhere, at any time, if it means talking about the principles of constitutionally limited government. Doing this will require some reading and thinking, and ultimately a whole lot of talking, but it will work. We have to persuade others that the processes and personnel through which laws are made, enforced, and interpreted matter. Many around you won't care, at least initially, about the fact that some of the procedures established by the Constitution are not being followed. A lot of people are inclined to dismiss departures from the Constitution as a kind of harmless error. This is where analogies can help. If you have friends who claim not to care whether this or that aspect of the Constitution is being circumvented in Washington, try making a comparison to something smaller and more familiar. Ask your friends to imagine, for example, that their local homeowners association was created for 3 limited purposes: to ensure the adequacy of streetlights, to provide for the maintenance of parks and other common areas, and to arrange for the weekly removal of garbage. Ask your friends to imagine further that the association is governed by a 7-member board, chosen at an annual meeting of the association's members, and that, once elected, the board is empowered to make all decisions affecting the association with one exception. Any decision to increase the monthly fees paid by homeowners must be approved at the annual homeowners association meeting. Finally, ask your friends to imagine that the association's 7-member board decided to increase the monthly fees paid by homeowners by 25% without seeking approval from the association's members, and to begin imposing fines on homeowners who failed to keep their dogs behind a fence or on a leash. Alternatively, ask them to imagine that the association's 7-member board adopted a nutritional standards rule, requiring each homeowner to certify in writing each month that all of the occupants of his or her home are consuming at least 2 servings of green vegetables each day. My guess is that, to one degree or another, your friends would express some outrage if their homeowners association did any of these things, especially given that each action outlined earlier would plainly not be authorized by the association's own rules. Most of your friends would never stand for such excesses. If they wouldn't allow their homeowners association to overstep the rules put in place to limit its own very narrow authority, why should they be willing to let their national government, which spends nearly 25 cents out of every dollar that moves through the American economy each year, do things it has no business doing and ignore the procedures it is required to follow? Once you have asked this question, you will have made significant progress in explaining the importance of limited government. The next step is simple. Ask your friends and family to read the Constitution. It is short. With its amendments, it contains less than 8,000 words and can be read in its entirety in less than an hour. It is written in relatively plain, simple English, and it is still very, very relevant to what is going on in our country today. Most important, reading the Constitution tends to change the way people think about the federal government, how it operates, and how it should operate. It prompts members of the public to view what happens in Washington not with blind faith or a resigned sense of powerlessness, but with a healthy degree of skepticism and informed understanding. As people read and begin to understand the Constitution, they will start to see that, like the homeowners in the hypothetical scenario just outlined, those making decisions on their behalf are not always following the rules by which they are bound. In short, if we want to restore the Constitution to its rightful place of prominence, we have to make sure that we, and those around us, know what's in it. Because, as Justice Anthony Kennedy has said, you cannot preserve what you do not revere. You cannot protect what you do not comprehend. You cannot defend what you do not know. Actions. As soon as people start caring about and developing an understanding of the Constitution, many of them will want to know what they can do to help restore constitutionally limited government. When this happens, tell them that the best thing they can do is to have conversations just like the one you've had with them. Challenge them to have such conversations with at least 5 people they know. This alone can make a big difference. Those who care should also be encouraged to call or write to their senators and congressmen on issues that concern them, especially on issues of constitutional importance. When unelected bureaucrats promulgate a new, problematic regulation, voters should write to their elected representatives in Washington, reminding them that the power to make laws belongs to Congress, pointing out that federal regulations are costing the American economy roughly $2 trillion each year, and encouraging them to enact regulatory reform measures like the RAINS Act, which would help put Congress back in charge of, and once again make Congress accountable for, the task of lawmaking. In each instance, the message communicated to Washington needs to tie back to the Constitution, always focusing on the fact that as long as that document remains in force, officials in Washington need to follow it. The message needs to remind elected officials that the Constitution's entire purpose is to restrain government power. Absent such a purpose, we probably wouldn't need it. The message should also identify specific provisions of the Constitution that are at issue, paying special attention to big-picture constitutional restraints like separation of powers, think of the Legislative Powers Clause, putting Congress and not unelected bureaucrats in charge of lawmaking, and federalism, think of the 10th Amendment and Congress's limited powers. The importance of emphasizing federalism cannot be overstated. We must continually remind our government officials and our fellow Americans that federal power is limited, and that power not identified as federal by the Constitution is reserved to the states. This principle, we must explain, has the potential to give more Americans more of what they want from their government. Federalism, at its core, is neither liberal nor conservative. It is a principle that, where followed, allows diverse political viewpoints, which vary dramatically from one region to another, to be respected. Consider the way Americans' feelings about socialized medicine vary from state to state. Many people in Vermont, perhaps a solid majority, would like to have a single-payer, government-funded, government-operated healthcare system. By contrast, most people in Utah, my state, don't feel that way, and would probably be more content with less government intervention in healthcare than with more. In any event, the people in each state should have the chance to decide for themselves what kind of role they want the government to play in the provision of healthcare services. If most people in Vermont want a form of socialized medicine, then they should be able to move in that direction. They would be able to do that far more effectively, completely, and promptly if only the federal government would get out of the way. That is, if only the federal government didn't already occupy so much of the government-funded healthcare arena that relatively little discretion remains with the states. As it stands today, however, most of the people in Utah and most of the people in Vermont are not getting what they want in this area, because far too many of their decisions are being made on a national level rather than on a state-by-state basis. This wouldn't happen if those holding federal offices showed more respect for principles of federalism. They should do so, not just because federalism is required by the Constitution, but also because federalism, when followed conscientiously, creates a system that allows people throughout the country to get more of what they want from their government and less of what they don't want. Federalism, in short, protects our country's rich viewpoint diversity. We need to start embracing it and stop avoiding it. It will allow more Americans to have more of the kind of government they want. Along the way, expect to encounter some resistance from those who have become convinced that having a big, powerful government, one that need not be restrained by an ancient document, is somehow a good thing. Be prepared to make the case that an unrestrained, all-powerful government isn't the answer to all of mankind's ailments, and that such a government has the potential to make our problems much, much worse. Elections. Finally, we have to bring our knowledge of the Constitution with us to the ballot box. And we have to vote differently, especially when it comes to federal offices. More than at any point in the past, freedom-loving Americans should support only those candidates for federal office who have read, understand, and are deeply committed to the limited government principles embodied in the Constitution. While this task may sound difficult, it's relatively easy to separate the wheat from the chaff once you know what questions to ask candidates seeking your vote. To start the conversation with or about the candidate in question, begin by inquiring generally into what the candidate sees as the purpose of the federal government. Any answer that fails prominently to emphasize the limited nature of federal power, or that describes federal power in an open-ended fashion, is unsatisfactory. Thus, if a candidate says that the federal government's purpose is to ensure that Americans are prosperous and well-educated, further inquiry is in order. Americans should, of course, be prosperous and well-educated. But in this context, how we get there matters. When Congress does its job well, it helps us get to that place, not because Congress has the power to legislate into existence all of the precise means by which people become prosperous and well-educated, but because federal power, properly exercised, leaves individuals free to do what they do best, without interference from A, Congress, or B, the kinds of problems that Congress is duly and uniquely empowered to address. Congress has a defined role in American society and in our system of government, not an open-ended one. In that respect, Congress should rarely be in a position to claim credit or accept blame for the overall state of America's economy, or for the quality of its education system. If Congress is respecting the limited nature of its power, its primary impact on such things will be indirect. If, for example, Congress failed to make adequate provisions for our national defense, then both our economy and our education system would be placed at risk. But that does not mean that Congress can always claim credit or accept blame for the strength of the economy or the quality of public education throughout the country. A candidate for federal office who promises the sun, moon, and stars should be viewed with a healthy degree of skepticism, especially if he or she fails even to attempt to square such promises with constitutional limitations on federal power. A satisfactory answer to a question about the nature of federal power will always entail some recognition that the federal government's powers are, as James Madison described them in Federalist 45, few and defined, while those reserved to the states are numerous and indefinite. A good answer will summarize briefly the powers granted to Congress in Article 1, Section 8, and elsewhere in the Constitution. At a minimum, such an answer should acknowledge that the powers of Congress extend to the regulation of commerce between the states and with foreign nations, and the power to provide for our national defense. A better answer will recognize that Congress has drifted considerably from the entire notion that it possesses only limited, enumerated powers. Such an answer should acknowledge the unmistakable connection among A. the dramatic increase of federal spending as a percentage of GDP over the last 80 years, B. the deferential standards of review applied by the Supreme Court in reviewing acts of Congress, and C. Congress's failure to limit its own authority independently of the Supreme Court. The best answer will be one that provides specific examples of legislation that the candidate will oppose because they cannot be reconciled with the candidate's reading of the Constitution, even if the laws could withstand a constitutional challenge in court based on the permissive standards established by misguided precedents. Extra credit should be given to any candidate who acknowledges that members of Congress are required to take an oath to uphold the Constitution, and that this oath binds lawmakers to do more than simply restrain their power to the extent they are ordered to do so by the Supreme Court. Some people, including many self-described constitutionalists, respond to this point by insisting that it is, after all, the Supreme Court's job to interpret the Constitution. That statement may be true as far as it goes. When litigants bring a dispute to the attention of a court with jurisdiction over it, the judiciary will supply the interpretation as necessary to resolve the underlying dispute. In countless other circumstances, however, the courts have no occasion even to consider questions of constitutional dimension. Parties disputing the proper interpretation of one or more words in the Constitution may, for instance, choose to resolve their dispute on their own, without ever asking the courts to get involved. Unless the courts are asked, no court will weigh in on the constitutional dispute at issue. And unless a court weighs in on the constitutional dispute, there will be no judicial precedent on the issue. The absence of judicial intervention in these areas hardly obviates the need for officials in the political branches to consider the constitutional implications of their actions. Quite to the contrary, if anything, the fact that many disputes are not resolved by the courts only underscores the solemn duty of those who serve in the political branches of government to faithfully defend the Constitution. For example, in impeachment proceedings, members of Congress understand they are the ultimate arbiters of whether the individual at issue has committed treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. If that power has been abused, I am not aware of it. I can't help but wonder whether the absence of abuse in this area has something to do with the fact that members of Congress understand that in this area, the buck really does stop with them. They can't rely on the federal courts to clean up any mistakes they might make. Perhaps when they feel a sense of ultimate stewardship and accountability, they act more responsibly. If anything, I wonder whether Congress may have been too cautious in wielding the impeachment power, erring on the side of caution so much that presidents have been emboldened to act like kings. Many times I have been asked what Congress can do in response to an out-of-control executive. My response is that the Constitution has given Congress two tools to deal with this kind of problem. One is the withholding of funds, as discussed earlier. The other is impeachment. When I worked at the U.S. Supreme Court, I occasionally had opportunities to show visitors around the building, which is a true but often uncelebrated architectural masterpiece. In preparing for such opportunities, I paid special attention to the symbolic architectural and artistic features of our nation's highest tribunal. I learned all I could about the building and its history. This exercise gave additional meaning to my experience working at the court. At times it seemed as though my work, which involved assisting Justice Alito as a law clerk, was somehow informed and enhanced by the symbols adorning the building. Those symbols underscore the sacred trust placed in government by the people, reminding jurists and visitors alike that human virtues and vices interact in a way that makes governing a complex and often risky endeavor. The stories told by those symbols inform the public of the High Court's purpose and the role of law, justice, and jurisprudence in our society. My experience at the Supreme Court has served as an informative backdrop to my time in the U.S. Senate, where, working at the Capitol, just across the street from the court, my thoughts are unavoidably influenced by beautiful and poignant images presented on canvas and in wood, plaster, and stone. From one end of the Capitol to the other, the building is filled with depictions of liberty and all that our nation treasures, symbols of strength, wisdom, order, virtue, charity, and self-restraint. The symbols themselves and all that they represent make the Capitol not only aesthetically pleasing but also thought-provoking. In every corridor, one can see eagles representing foresight and freedom, scales representing justice, scrolls and tablets representing our laws and our Constitution, and countless other symbols that are timelessly connected to the American psyche. One sculpture, Liberty and the Eagle, by Enrico Causici, consistently captures my attention and my imagination. I am drawn to it not only because of its inherent beauty and unique style, but also because it incorporates so many symbols into a single work of art. Perched on a high ledge in the chamber used by the House of Representatives from 1807 to 1857, this sculpture combines multiple thematic elements representing the ideals of our nation and our form of government. The centerpiece of this work is a tall woman in flowing, regal robes, Liberty. The scroll she holds in her outstretched right hand is the U.S. Constitution, an instrument of liberty delivered by Liberty herself. To her right is an eagle, the high-flying symbol of American power, foresight, and freedom. At her left is a fasces, an ancient Roman symbol of strength consisting of a tightly bound bundle of sticks. Although each stick in the bundle is small and relatively weak on its own, the sticks become surprisingly strong when they are bound together. It's a common architectural representation of the phrase e pluribus unum, out of many, one. To me, the most fascinating part of Liberty and the Eagle is the creature coiled tightly around the fasces, as if holding it together. A snake. Every time I see this sculpture, I find the snake a little unsettling, in much the same way I feel queasy whenever and wherever I happen to see a snake, whether in my backyard, in the wilderness, or even in a glass cage at a zoo or pet store. Although this snake isn't real, I still find it startling to see it depicted as somehow holding our republic together. Very few Americans, if asked what species of fauna or flora best represents the ideals of America, would identify any reptile, much less the snake. Culturally, we have come to associate the snake with deception. Regardless of the reasons, most Americans would probably agree that snakes are mysterious animals that, when used as symbols, send a message that is at best mixed. With all of this in mind, I have often wondered what could possibly have convinced the sculptor of Liberty and the Eagle to feature the snake so prominently in a sculpture that, in every other respect, seems to capture so much of what is virtuous and admirable about America. Enrico Causici isn't here to give us his own explanation, so we are left to wonder on our own. Given my own affinity for the biblical symbolism prevalent throughout the Capitol, my personal interpretation of this piece is influenced by the Bible. When I see this sculpture, I think of Jesus' admonition that his followers be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. When Jesus uttered those words, his listeners would likely have associated the serpent with the capacity to discern between good and evil. It was the serpent that convinced Adam and Eve to partake of the forbidden fruit, the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, as described in Genesis, by promising them that if they did so, they would be as gods, knowing good and evil. Telling his followers to be wise as serpents could thus have emphasized the need to be discerning and to be aware of and on the lookout for evils that might come among them. This interpretation takes on additional meaning when one considers that the wise as serpents admonition was uttered as an addendum to Jesus' warning that his followers would sometimes be sent forth as sheep in the midst of wolves. This part of the Bible warns readers of a harsh reality. Those who are inclined to harm others sometimes fail to recognize that they might be surrounded by people who, contrary to their carefully managed appearances, are the opposite of innocent. Hence the need for Jesus' followers to be wise as serpents but harmless as doves. Perhaps Liberty and the Eagle sends a secular version of the same message. I wonder whether Enrico Causici wanted to remind Americans that while most of us have high aspirations for good government, we must not allow ourselves to assume that the aspirations of those around us, particularly those who are elected to serve in the Capitol, are equally devoted to the noble principles upon which our country was founded. If this interpretation is correct, then this serpent warns us that the system established by the Constitution will become subject to abuse even by those who take oaths to protect it. The U.S. Constitution was written to make the men and women of America free, but it can succeed in protecting them only when it is followed, and only when the people take steps to prevent it from being distorted and ultimately used against them. As a peace-loving people, we must be harmless as doves. But as a people charged with the task of protecting ourselves from threats to our liberty, we must also be wise as serpents. What then do we need to watch out for as Americans? How can we identify our political wolves, those who threaten our freedom and form of government, even as they remain concealed behind sheep's clothing? The founding generation understood that almost anyone entrusted with the levers of government power has the potential to become a wolf, and that government officials must therefore be checked at every turn. In Federalist 51, James Madison gives us a good window into the founding generation's concerns in this area. Indeed, he suggested that the very need for the Constitution's system of checks and balances is itself a reflection on human nature, and that government itself may properly be described as the greatest of all reflections on human nature. He went on to reason that if men were angels, no government would be necessary, and that if angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. But alas, Madison concluded, men are not angels, and we have yet to find a way for angels to govern men. We must therefore frame a government which is to be administered by men over men, taking into account the harsh reality that human nature routinely causes men to abuse government power. This can be achieved only with great difficulty. We must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place, oblige it to control itself. Federalist 51 points out that a Republican form of government that holds public officials accountable through regular elections is itself not enough to prevent politicians from abusing their power. Elections naturally create within the government a dependence on the people. Aware of this dynamic, public officials naturally seek to turn this relationship on its head by making the people dependent on government, thereby strengthening the tie between big government and the politicians who traffic in it. Thus, experience has taught mankind the necessity of auxiliary precautions. In other words, we need checks on government power, including federalism and the separation of powers, that go above and beyond what can be achieved through regular elections. Elections, in the absence of auxiliary precautions, could actually enhance the risk that government officials will abuse their power by promoting the appearance that such officials are sheep, that their interests are seemingly aligned with those of the people they represent. Meanwhile, elected officials rely increasingly on a familiar campaign message: you need me to make government work for you. In spreading this message, they don't just mask their self-serving intentions. They obscure and diminish the Constitution by acting as if the lawmaker is more important than the law. They don't just disguise their role as marketers of corruption and dysfunction. They undermine the role of the Constitution by putting their own personality in its place. This explains why so many take an oath to honor the Constitution, but then work tirelessly to weaken it. It is the Constitution itself that makes government work for the people, and that is why there is an oath to uphold it, and a constant temptation by those in power to marginalize it. I therefore see the snake in Liberty and the Eagle as a sobering reminder of the need for us as citizens to discern the difference between good and evil, between sheep and wolves masquerading as sheep, and between hard-working Americans sustaining constitutional principles and government officials wielding unchecked power. For too long, the enemies of limited government have been winning this battle. While those who love freedom are coalescing in record numbers to mount a resistance, the struggle is far from over. We are still the stewards of the country we have inherited, and we won't be fooled forever by the shenanigans of the ill-intentioned or short-sighted. This nation is, and will continue to be, a light to all other nations, a treasure purchased by blood and built by the hearts, minds, and determination of its people. We will preserve what we value and understand, and the outcome of this process will shape the fate of our constitutionally protected republic for the better. Although we have plenty of reasons to be concerned about our republic state, I am nothing but optimistic about its fate. I am not like Jimmy Stewart's Mr. Smith, battling for a lost cause because, Lost causes are the only causes worth fighting for. Nor am I as fatalistic as that great fighter for human freedom, Whittaker Chambers, who believed communists were on history's winning side, and with resignation said, "It is better to die on the losing side than to live under communism." To be sure, the Constitution has taken a beating over the years, and restoring it is a daunting endeavor. Nevertheless, on our side are the values of the American people. We don't want Washington politicians taking away our right to self-defense. We don't want any but the most accountable representatives to have the power to raise our taxes. We don't want unelected bureaucrats imposing mountains of regulations with trillions of dollars of costs. We don't want federal judges barring all religious utterance from the public square. We don't want Big Brother snooping into our most private affairs. We don't want what the founding generation would never have ratified and what subsequent generations have never endorsed, a federal government of unlimited power. Instead, as Americans, we desire a limited government of checks and balances that protect individual liberty. By the millions, we have an instinctive attraction to these principles. Because they form the backbone of this nation, the Constitution will always have a fighting chance. Winston Churchill famously said, "Americans can always be counted on to do the right thing after they have exhausted all other possibilities." I'm not sure I can agree with the second half of that sentence, but I think we can accept the first half of it as a profound compliment. The American people can always be counted on to do the right thing. George Washington expressed a similar sentiment in 1787. In a letter to his nephew, Bushrod Washington, expressing his confidence in the recently proposed Constitution, the future president wrote, "The power under the Constitution will always be in the people. It is entrusted for certain defined purposes and for a certain limited period to representatives of their own choosing. And whenever it is executed contrary to their interest or not agreeable to their wishes, their servants can and undoubtedly will be recalled." What George Washington wrote in 1787 remains true today. Whenever we, as a people, decide that the Constitution is being executed contrary to our interest and in a manner not agreeable to our wishes, we will start to care differently, act differently, and vote differently as we seek for the limitations on power that have been promised and yet are lost. That vindication will begin when we embrace the opportunity for a real national discussion about the meaning of our Constitution. We must be patient, but persistent. We must be honest about the meaning of the words written in the summer of 1787 and on subsequent occasions when the Constitution was amended. We must understand how their meaning has been forgotten. We must be able to point to the key passages of our nation's highest law, demand that our elected officials respect them, and hold each of those officials accountable for disregarding them. I hope this book will be a part of the beginning of that conversation. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Our Lost Constitution, The Willful Subversion of America's Founding Document by Mike Lee. Performed by Mike Lee and Tom Parks. Engineered by Matt Churchill.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.